Welcome to the Basis War and Everything. I'm Scratch, joining us my co-host, Base Tavanian.
Hey guys, thank you for joining us in this bloody sweltering heat.
Well, it's sweltering here. It's bloody a hell in Queensland and in New South Wales, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And, you know, you can actually make a donation to the Salvos if you want to do that. I still believe they do very good work, even if they don't hire homos or whatever it was they were accused of before.
Yeah, and that's just making them sound like an ideal charity.
Absolutely.
Where, and not like certain people starting scholarships for white people and then taking all the money and spending it on champagne.
Yeah, but look, let's be absolutely honest about all these bushfires. We've never had them before, and they are a direct result of burning coal.
Yes.
If you were to believe Jordan Steele John, otherwise known as Moss from the IT crowd, blaming the Liberal senators for being arsonists, as he yelled out in the Senate yesterday.
They're arson around.
So, okay. This is a political issue, like, no matter what way you kind of want to chop it, you know, like, both sides of politics here accusing the others of, like, politicizing the issue. If you ask me, you know, everything is political anyway. So it's somewhat of a moot point. But what has really been giving me the shits the most about this is the attacks on Barnaby Joyce. And these attacks have been coming from the left and the right. I don't know if you saw that even Andrew Bolt had a go at him over this. Now, I think Bolt does that every now and then just to kind of like give the appearance that he's just as willing to take aim at the people on the right, you know, as he is people on the left, even though he had absolutely no reason to do this. So, but let's look at how SBS was covering this. So this is how the beginning of this article reads. Nationals MP Barnaby Joyce has suggested two people who died in the New South Wales bushfires most likely voted for the Greens, as he blamed the minor party for increasing the threat of bushfires. Okay, so you've got two things there. One, apparently he's politicising it by blaming the Greens for increasing the threat of bushfires, which, by the way, is true. We'll get to that in a bit. But the second thing is that he's made this implication about them actually being Greens voters. Now, I don't know about you, but when I read that, what I thought they were trying to say there was that Barnaby was saying that they deserve death because they were Greens voters, you know? Certainly anyone that I've asked about that, they're like, yeah, that's the implication that I
got. Yeah, I was about to be like, oh man, Barnaby's been really based since he's been on the back bench. First talking about, like, you know, poor whites in the rural areas, now talking about frying Greens. I mean, gosh.
But I would like
literal wignat.
I would now like to read out the full quote here. I acknowledge that the two people who died were most likely people who voted for the Green Party, so I am not going to start attacking them. That's the last thing I want to do. Now, that quote just debunks both implications in that headline, okay? First of all, he was not blaming the Greens for increasing the threat of bushfires. He actually just said in there, I don't want to start attacking them. That's the last thing I want to do. And also, he was saying that one of the reasons why he doesn't want to do that is because he acknowledges that some of the people who died in these bushfires, including these two people, probably voted Greens.
I mean,
so it's the complete opposite of what this fucking story was. And the exact same thing was run on the ABC, by the way.
Yeah.
The exact same thing. So I couldn't believe that, like Bolt actually had a perfect opportunity to call out this bullshit, yet at the same time, he took a shot at Joyce as well. This was total crap. Now, the other thing is, I can't remember the shire or the council or whatever that this was in, but the reason why I said that is because their mayor is a Green, right? So that's, like, you know, by deduction, he concluded that they probably voted Greens. They probably didn't, because no one votes in those bloody elections, by the way. They were probably just all, you know, grounds towards Green candidates who probably didn't even live in the bloody area and were rolled out, as they very often do. But nonetheless, he was kind of saying, like, because of the devastation of these bushfires, let's put politics aside. Let's call a truce.
Let's get on the negotiation table. Let's
exactly. Yet,
put aside the rhetoric.
But even though he said all of that, they still fucking went after him full pelt and took that quote completely out of context. And fuck, why didn't the Australians, the Australian newspaper and Sky News point that out? I don't know. Anyway, Barnaby, oh, sorry, one other thing that is, and this is actually in the article, it's amazing. Later down, he says here, I completely condone that this is climate change, so let's put that to one side. And I acknowledge that things are getting drier. We're in a record drought. I mean, it's the bleeding obvious. Okay? So, if anything there, if he was politicizing it, he was agreeing with the Greens. You know? He was actually politicizing it in the way that they would want him to do.
Oh, man, he's moving to a third position right here.
Yeah. Now, the Australian actually had this story about the hippies in Nimbin, which, you know, is up in Queensland. The Greens in Nimbin, they're like, besides maybe some that are in Tasmania, they're like really the only ruralite greenies that we have in the country, you know.
Mm.
Everyone else is in the cafes in inner city Melbourne. But even they were saying, because these are, I guess, some greenies who have some sense because they actually are, you know, salt of the earth kind of people, that yes, these Greens councils are partly to blame because they have not conducted the controlled burns that, you know, create breakpoints, you know, so that fires don't spread. And that because of that, you know, you've just basically got this big long chain of dry vegetation, meaning that once a fire picks up, it spreads really quickly and then threatens housing and everything. You know, they've acknowledged this. And yes, this is part of what we need to go back to, is we need to roll back this green tape. We need to vote out these bloody councillors that are bloody Greens members. And we need to reintroduce the controlled burns again. Not the types that the Aborigines did, right? Because they were uncontrolled burns. But we need to do proper controlled burns to stop the bushfires spreading. You know, this has worked before.
Oh, if they're going, but according to The Guardian, the New South Wales Department of Planning and Industry told The Guardian Australia that it has increased control burns because of funding to the RFS and national parks.
Look, there are certain areas where that has happened, yes. But for example, in Nimbin, no, it hasn't. You know?
Yes.
It basically all depends on who's running a council.
Yeah.
Is it Greens or isn't it? If it's Greens, it won't happen. You know, I mean, sometimes when you do these burns, you do kill a couple of animals.
Well, yeah.
That's true. But, you know, in typical Greens fashion, they value the life of animals above humans.
And even plants.
Yes, that's right. Now, did you have anything else to add on the bushfires before we
segue? No. So, I just didn't really care about them. I mean, I care about the fucking people that, like, lost their lives to this fucking thing.
Yeah, but just the whole political debate surrounding it is a bit, yeah. I mean, I do somewhat agree that, you know, that is a kind of a time to lay down arms and just say, all right, we just need to pull together and help people.
Yep.
Definitely.
Christie and Obama style.
Yeah. But, I mean, the idea that there aren't political implications to it, no. You know, there's political implications to everything. Anyway, now, another reason why I mentioned these control burns is that whenever you read an article from The Australian and they mention the need for the control burns, and yes, they should point that out, they always then have to say, like the Indigenous Australians used to do, right? You know, this is one of these things where, you know, hammered into your head and in school, certainly, about how, you know, the Aborigines had this perfect harmonious relationship with land, and, you know, the reason why they were nomadic is because, you know, that they were just hunt and gather in one area and move on so that it would all kind of grow back for next time.
There was just enough of it to go.
Yeah, which is a lot of crap. But yeah, the other one was that they knew in order to prevent bushfires, and fucking what's his name? Warren Mundine has been out on Twitter. I think you trolled him on Twitter actually the other day.
Well, I just said, you know, he was pulling the we was caretakers is what I
yes,
like to call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, and that's what we're going to get to here. But no, the main reason that the Aborigines did that was to flush out animals, right? They weren't even very good hunters. Like, as a really quick way to flush them out of, like, you know, an area of vegetation was just cause a big fucking fire and they'll all run out in one direction and then we can catch them. And they weren't controlled either. A lot of them were actually totally out of control, you know. They burnt, like, half this bloody country, yeah. like, to smouldering ash. Anyway, the other reason I mention this is because, you know, there are, like, the Aboriginal Kang stuff, if we're, you know, we're talking an equivalent here. There's been many of these for a while. You know, the dot paintings is one. The Aboriginal flag, which is actually like a copyrighted emblem. What else? There's even evidence that, you know, the boomerangs and the didgeridoo.
You know, people have had boomerangs since before that we've arrived in Australia.
Yeah. And like I said, the control burns thing. But in the past couple of years, I don't know if this is just, you know, kind of in tandem with what's been going on in America and the whole Afrocentrism thing. But we've also been told that Aborigines were astronomers, you know, because there was an Aboriginal
Stonehenge,
which was just a bloody collection of pebbles out on the grass.
Well, they were just barely hiving little grass blades.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. But the most recent one is this idea that they were farmers, and that part of the reason why this has been covered up is because when Europeans came here, Aborigines had these big stockpiles of grain, and because they were just, you know, the greedy looting Europeans, they went and just looted and stole all the grain, right? It was actually pretty much the reverse, although Aborigines didn't really steal grain, they would steal livestock. Now, the guy who's been peddling this is this guy called Bruce Pascoe. He's also known as a Dark Emu, and his most recent book is called Dark Emu. Now, really good website to go to, dark-emu-exposed, really taking some note from Stryker there, I think, .org. Now, you go there, whoever it is who does this site, definitely not our guys, they're really careful to kind of tiptoe around the sensitivity of, you know, Aboriginal identity and all that kind of thing, but it's dedicated to debunking this idea that they had any form of agriculture, really. There were very unsophisticated forms of agriculture in the Torres Strait Islander people, but mainland Aborigines, no, there was not. In fact, something that I learned from this site was that even when it came to harvesting yams, which is another thing we're told in high school, that, you know, they were really good at growing yams, they were actually taught that by the Dutch. So even these old kind of myths that, you know, aren't so spectacular as Stonehenge and sophisticated farming, even a lot of them are actually not true, you know. But that's why, like, I'm actually somewhat willing to let Aborigines have that stuff. It's like out of sympathy. It's like, yeah, okay, you invented the boomerang, you invented dot paintings, you have nothing else, so you can have them.
It's even like, he's even sourcing, like, Jared Diamond in his book.
Really? I didn't know that. So, yeah, I think he's always been, like, somewhat known as Australia's...
But it's not funny because he's citing Jared Diamond saying, you know, Australia is a sole continent where, in modern times, all native peoples still lived without any of the hallmarks of so-called civilization. Without farming, herding, metal, bows, arrows, substantial buildings, settled villages, riding chiefdoms or states, instead Australian Aborigines were nomadic or semi-nomadic hunter-gatherers, organized into bands, living in temporary shelters or huts and still dependent on stone tools.
Hmm. Mm. But I mean, you know,
While New Guinea developed both animal husbandry and agriculture, Australia developed neither.
Yeah, right. So, that was from Jared Diamond.
Yeah.
Right, well, there you go. Even Diamond admits it. But, you know, like, the really funny thing about, you know, Jared Diamond's thesis is because what he's basically saying is without, you know, agriculture, that accounts for the disadvantage, but that doesn't mean that those people aren't any less intelligent. It just accounts for them not being able to develop a civilization and an economy, etc. Now, what's really funny about that is that that in itself actually debunks his own thesis, you know? There's this inner contradiction in that. And that's because agriculture sets off a feedback loop, you know? Because from what happens when you grow lots of food, you've got excess food, you trade it, so markets develop. What happens when markets develop? You introduce a currency. When you do that...
It flows from the river banks.
Right. And then when once you do that, you create competition.
And then you get the birth certificates.
All right. Yeah, so we get the picture. But then what happens is, because all of these other things arise, you know, like you need innovation, so you need science and technology, you need ways of out-competing all these other people, there's then all of these extra environmental pressures that put pressure on the population to be smarter. And so if you don't have agriculture in the first place, that feedback loop is never there. So that in itself actually accounts for why people don't get smarter. You get what I mean? And that's what Jared Diamond just completely misses, you know, the idea of the feedback loop. It's not even a very complicated concept, but it's one that he totally misses.
Well, yeah, when even Jared Diamond's like, oh, they were going to get agriculture, was essentially the whole quote. So, you know, he's going like, oh, they were going to get agriculture eventually because they had their fire stick farming and they started intensifying that.
Mm. But also, like, the very fact that Aborigines, because obviously Bruce Pascoe would have to admit that Aborigines, you know, for example, never created a two-story building or anything like that. Any of those other hallmarks of civilization.
Hey, mate, Stonehenge.
Yeah. So the thing is, though, if you had actually developed agriculture, sophisticated agriculture, as he claims, because he said they had stockpiles of grain, if they had done that, you would then have all of those other things like domesticated animals, two-story buildings, the wheel, you know, stuff like that. But they didn't. So that in itself kind of shows you why it just couldn't have been. If you have sophisticated agriculture, basically civilization follows in the centuries after that. Now, the other reason why we bring up this delightful fellow known as the Dark Emu is that he's not so dark. So he's basically, up until now, shown himself to be the Australian Tariq Nasheed, doing the whole we was astronomers and farmers thing. But now it seems that he's actually the Australian Sean King, because he's not even Aboriginal, right? Now, I have to admit that when I first saw him, I did think he was a little Aboriginal. Mainly because of his nose, actually.
Yeah, it's always the nose.
He has a little bit of an Abbo nose.
I think it's just boomer nose.
Yeah, I think also it may be a drinker's nose too.
Yeah.
You know, he's probably just a pisshead. But also, you know, just like Sean King, he's styled his hair and his beard to make himself
look
like
Well, the beard like is just not caring for it. Not applying beard oil or shit like that.
Yeah. I mean, Sean King actually has to kind of like fine-tune what's happening with his hair. With this guy, he just fucking lets it fly.
Yeah, he's at like a half. That's what he shaves at.
Yeah. So Andrew Bolt had been in contact with him for a number of months, I believe, asking him to show his Aboriginal lineage because he claims that his great-grandmother on his mother's side was Aboriginal, which would make him 1/8 Aboriginal, right? So he wouldn't even be that much of a blackfella. And at first glance, like I said, you'd think, oh, yeah, probably 1/8 Octoroon guy. Well, actually, no. There was a bunch of, like, genealogists, and I think they actually had some geneticists, was it? I can't remember off the top of my head from the video. But anyway, it was some genealogists who went and traced all this stuff back. Actually, no. His great-grandmother on his mother's side, English, okay? He's an Anglo. Like, and pretty much all of his ancestry was English as well. So, yeah, he's a total fake.
Eternal Anglo right there.
And, you know, besides the Bolt story, because I went and Googled this later, there's no coverage on it. You know, where's the ABC pointing out the cultural appropriation here, you know? They won't do it because to do so, people would then start questioning all the other stuff that he's saying here about the agriculture.
Well, then they'll start, you know, bringing up, you know, their rightful grievances against some Aboriginals, you know. Why do they get these licenses? Why do they get these free uni placements? Why do they get these uni placements despite shitty marks?
Yeah.
Why do they get free uni? Why do they get free Holdens?
So, I mean, here's what I actually kind of think was going on here. This guy is an academic historian. He's been around for a while talking about this kind of stuff. This is the exact thing that Bolt mentioned in the article that got him in trouble under 18C. If you can claim Aboriginality, you're automatically, you know, given a higher... It's black privilege, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, if you can go out there in public, most people, you know, even if they are 1/8 Aborigine, they usually kind of don't want to admit that.
I don't know about that.
Well, this is what I'm saying. The obvious exception is, like, if you can get something out of it, like this, you know, you can get that. And, you know, he's actually done this to... Because as soon as this Dark Emu book came out, this was a bestseller on the nonfiction list, you know. And he was getting all this airtime and ABC and everything. It's been pretty profitable for him. Oh. Anyway.
Well, it just reminds me of, like, the whole, like, little gatekeeper class of Aboriginal history as well, especially, like, Robert Mann, who's, like, probably the biggest example of that.
Oh, yeah. Did you see the debate he did with David Irving?
Yeah.
That's great. Irving wipes the floor with him.
Yes.
He leaves him speechless right at the end,
yeah.
Actually. I'm not sure if that one's still up, but it's great.
Nah, that one's been gone for ages. I've been trying to find it. But.
Yeah. And, you know, like, David Irving is a real revisionist historian.
Yeah.
In that what he revises
is true. He writes real history.
Yeah. This guy is a revisionist historian in the sense that it's all total crap. He's just implanting stories in the past. Mm. It's abocentrism. Can we coin that term?
Yeah. And then, you know, Robert Mann, he was head editor of Quadrants. Not Quantum. man, a James Bond movie about, like, a shady international criminalization. Huh?
That would be a shit movie.
The Quadrant of Solace. Anyway, he was head of Quadrant magazine as chief editor. But then he left because, it was becoming too right-wing, as in Keith Windschuttle got, like, things published on it. What a shock.
Oh, dear.
And if you don't know who that is, Keith Windschuttle writes the fabrication of Aboriginal history. And then there's, like, this little debate of, like, Windschuttle and Man. Known as the history wars.
So what? That I actually haven't heard of this guy. So in other words, he debunks abocentrism.
Pretty much.
Okay. Well, that's good. Yeah.
And, like, even claims of, like, you know, the British just, like, going out and, like, Eric killing them all.
Right. And looting their grain, apparently.
Yeah. Like, I remember a while ago I said, like, the black line, that the horizontal, or the vertical line going up and down Tasmania with British soldiers shooting Aboriginals everywhere they could was, like, just a lie. No, it wasn't exactly a lie. But you know how many Aboriginals that were killed because of it? 2.
Okay. Yeah.
So if that's, like, you know, a reasonable, pretty good, what do you call it, estimate of a population of fauna, what does that say about European impact on the Tasmanian Aboriginals?
Now, I was going to say, actually, that's another bloody myth drummed into in school, is the idea that the English, like, committed wholesale genocide of Tasmanian Aborigines. It just is not true. Anyway, you actually had some Abo news, didn't you?
Well, it's more about this whole, like, you know, they want the voice in Parliament.
Yeah, indigenous voice.
I mean, yeah. It might even, like, liven up Question Time if, you know, you've just got some totally, like, inebriated Aboriginal going on about this fucking land being stolen. Yeah.
Well, you know the Hong 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 thing in the South? That was actually because of that. That started because of a bunch of drunk members. Like, during, like, the intermissions, they were going to the bar and coming back.
And come on, I mean, let's not be too mean to the Aboriginals. I mean, Tony Abbott's even been drunk in Parliament.
Mm. Well, that was when he missed a vote.
Yeah.
That was a little different, but yeah. He didn't get up and, like, make a speech or anything.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Not like his night after this election where he had the big carton of beer.
That's of Corona, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's right. A better taste in beer. If he was having it with lemon, it would be all right.
Well, if he was just having it to get fucking shit-faced, I mean...
That's what I would have done.
The thing with Corona is you can just like get shit-faced on it really fast. I mean, that's why it's sold in the club.
Yeah. It's like the most overrated premium beer, though.
Yeah, it's just trash.
Anyway, what about this Leibler guy?
Yes,
yeah, that's actually his name, Leibler.
So Mark Leibler, you know, who's the co-chair of the referendum council that oversaw the Uluru statement, used government. He was saying, you know, the voice of parliament could pave the way for the body to be enshrined in the constitution, as he urges supporters of the Uluru statement from the heart to embrace the government's new process. And, you know, he's just pretty much, the whole article is him pretty much saying, don't be too mad at the coalition. They're eventually going to come around and, you know, do this Aboriginal voice. And
they probably will. Yeah. I mean, who's the Indigenous Affairs Minister?
Ken Wyatt.
Yes.
Ken White.
Who has flagged that and the idea of a treaty. So, yeah, I think they will.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Morrison, because he's a bigger shapeshifter than, you know, anyone I've ever seen.
Any reptilian.
Yeah. You know, and he says, use the government's backflip on the Banking Royal Commission example for potential for a policy change. And, you know, but the government has launched a co-design process for a legislative voice, a separate process including Indigenous Australians in a nation's birth certificate. We all need to understand that the Prime Minister is not about to create a split in the coalition over this. Political parties have learned the hard way that disunity is death, which means the best way to proceed on this is to work quietly through the co-design process. Yes, quietly behind the shadows.
Yeah.
The reality of the consultation process around this constitutional recognition, which is unlikely to be anywhere as near comprehensive as the referendum councils, may come to the same conclusion we did, which will collapse the two processes back into one another. Another reality is that adjustments to government policy in line with prevailing community statement are a hallmark of healthy democracy. Well, I don't know. Have you consulted anyone whether they welcome this, Mark?
Yeah.
Besides, you know, the 100 people at this forum, including property developer Maury Schwartz, former Banking Royal Commissioner Kenneth Hayne, Australian Bar Association President Jennifer Batruni, SC, and representatives from BHP, Energy Australia, KPMG, and the Business Council of Australia, and Ken Wyatt.
Of course. You know, look, I was just going to say, I should have made this point also when we're talking about the dark emu and that, is that any kind of gains Aborigines make in terms of entrenching political influence is always either done by, you know, these bloody octoroons or 1/16th, and very often by people who aren't even Aboriginal, okay, as the dark emu is. Now, I know that he's a historian, that's a little different, but nonetheless, again, I refer to the Andrew Bolt article, you know. A lot of these people who claim Aboriginality, very often it's like Elizabeth Warren, you know. Like, Elizabeth Warren, I'm willing to entertain the idea that she actually believed she was, you know, part Cherokee. Because a lot of Americans and Canadians do think that. But then when they kind of go down the line, they realize, no, actually, it's not true.
Well, it's like that 23andMe thing about why aren't I showing up as Native American?
Yeah, that's right. So if we were to get this, you know, third chamber or whatever it would be, it wouldn't even really be an Indigenous voice, you know? It would be run by all these octoroons and, like I said, some people who aren't even Aboriginal at all, you know? I mean, even Ken Wyatt is like an octoroon himself, isn't he?
I think he's, yeah.
Or a quarter, maybe? I thought
he was like quarter white. Oh, I might be thinking of Ben Wyatt.
I don't know. I know they're cousins, but yeah. I don't know. He's certainly not full-blooded. No way.
No.
You know, if you've seen, like, the full-blooded Aborigines from, like, up in the Kimberley and that, they're almost as dark as the Sudanese. In fact, some of them are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Some of the the pure bloods. When there's like going back to the certain myths that they're told about, especially about stolen generations, is like to preserve white genetic purity, we wanted the half castes to be integrated into our society.
Yeah, like
which is like isn't that the other way around logic there? But if Anglo-Saxon Australians back then were so obsessed with their racial purity, weren't they going to be wanting to push out?
Right, that's the thing. Again, that's like a self-detonating thesis there. It's like the contradiction is actually within the very argument. I can't believe they don't see this stuff. Just give a little bit of the backstory on Leibler.
Well, I will in a minute, but just so you know, like, because Ken Wyatt, who was at the Melbourne event last month, launched a co-design process for a legislative voice, which will be led by Uluru Statement supporters Marsha Langdon. And if you remember Marsha Langdon, she's that Aboriginal woman with the dyed white hair that was on Q&A.
Yes.
And then that Q&A on May.
She's like another academic.
She like pushed hard for Holocaust denial laws in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah, I do remember.
Yeah. And that very triggering last 15 minutes of Q&A.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is just panic attack, but...
Yeah.
But... And like Professor Tom Kalmer, Leibler said that Professor Kalmer quite reasonably argued there needs to be more detail around the voice before it is put to a referendum. detail may be set out in legislation, but that will neither preclude nor substitute for a constitutional amendment down the track once people have seen the detail. And Leibler said he had met with six Conservative MPs who had misgivings about the voice proposal. I feel there is some prospect that their fears around the voice can be alleviated through the co-design process. Which, you know, means, don't worry, I'm going to convince them to support it in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the funny thing with Marsha Langdon, why, like, her and, like, Ken Wyatt, like, what is the common factor that's bringing them together? It's like not so much the kosher sandwich in that term, but it's like the kosher billabong, I guess.
Okay.
The kosher grub.
Well, yeah. I mean, look.
The corroborated grub.
I mean, obviously, it's on a much lower scale than in America, but we do have this kind of Jewish lobbying or meddling that, yeah, eventually kind of pushes through crap like this. Mm. But
well,
and I mean, look, if we do ever have this Indigenous voice, it won't be at Third Chamber, though. I don't think. It will just kind of be this, like a non-binding chamber of the parliament, you know. Yeah. That doesn't mean it won't have any influence, but, you know, they won't pass any laws or they certainly won't be a house of review or anything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just going back to Leibler, if you wanted me to get into his background.
Yeah.
From his law firm, Arnold Bloch Leibler Lawyers and Advisors. He's the senior partner. And, you know, I'm just looking at some of the other lawyers that I see is Henry Lanza, Joey Berendsgen, Jonathan Kaplan.
Ah, related to Brian Kaplan, maybe.
Oh, I wonder. Jeremy Leibler, Zavan Murderossian, I think he's an Armenian.
Okay.
Paul Rubenstein, Stephen Sharp, Peter Seidel, Leon Zweier.
Okay.
Oh my God! Just keep scrolling down. Raphael Leibler.
Okay. Are they on forged passports?
We'll get to that. Oh man, it is. Oh my God, it is like I'm in New York.
The cast of Seinfeld right there.
Yeah. I mean, these guys genetically look like they were born in Israel. And Carolyn Golden.
Oh, jeez.
But yeah, but from Arnold Bloch Leibler's website, it quotes Mark Leibler, has close ties with some of the nation's most powerful people in politics and business for decades.
I'm sure.
And the links to an article from News Corp, as in news.com.au, where it also cites people like David Gonski, Leon Zweier.
Is Gonski's not a Jew, though, is he?
Yeah, he's Jewish.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But it's kind of funny because I can kind of get behind some of
That's probably why I didn't think he was Jewish.
But yeah, and then Colin Goldschmidt as well, and he's like powerful power brokers of Canberra. But Liebler is known for Kevin Rudd saying that he played a part in getting Julia to do a leadership challenge. That because of Rudd kicking out Mossad agents on Australian passports who are coming here to assassinate a Hamas official.
So is this perhaps like a hidden story behind the ousting of Rudd?
Well, Rudd says so, but Liebler says that I or some mythical pro-Israel conspiracy somehow had a role in Julie Gillard's success in overthrowing Mr. Rudd.
Yeah,
approximating the threat quote in the article was said by me or anyone else. He said, adding that the then Prime Minister had merely been sensitive and defensive when Mr. Liebler raised Ms. Gillard's record on Israel.
Okay. Look, I still think that the number one factor was Rudd being a prick.
Yeah. Just losing all the inner support.
Yeah. Caucus basically thought he was a psychopathic prick and didn't want to work with him anymore.
And he was doing everyone's job.
Yeah. There are, like, multiple testimonials from people, you know. Mm. Look at how many people resigned from the front bench. I think there was at least six when he came back.
But Jewish groups were publicly critical of Rudd's government's treatment of the Israelis at the time, but in his book, Rudd writes that the country had previously offended in 2003, and he was advised by officials to act firmly and decisively to punish Mossad for breaching a signed agreement to stop forging passports. Rudd suggested Ms. Gillard was not enthusiastic about the Australian response and said, I know for a fact that Julia had been cultivating the Israeli lobby in Australia. In the extract from his book, The PM Years, Rudd said, Mr. Lieber's perceived threat about aiding Ms. Gillard was made when he, in the course of the Canberra tour, offered the Jewish leader a briefing on Israel's conduct. He said, Julie's looking very good in the public eye these days. She's performing very strongly. She's a great friend of Israel. But you shouldn't be anxious about her, should you, Prime Minister? And then the former Labour leader, strong supporter of Israel, although a recent critic of Bibi, said he invited the Jewish leaders for dinner to discuss the government's response to the passport incidents out of respect to MPs Danby and Mark Dreyfus, who had lobbied him over the matter.
Wow. Man, I think I can safely say, without reading the book, that would be the most interesting thing in the whole thing.
besides, you know, negotiated specificity.
Out of like the fucking 700 odd pages that are in that book, yeah. I'd say that would be the only part worth reading.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe some part about the strip club, but
maybe. Well, he says he can't remember anything, so.
Yeah.
All right. So.
But it just goes to show, you know, it's like where I'm not seeing this like big thing about like China overthrowing Dutton as Minister for Home Affairs.
Yeah.
For like kicking out Huang Zhengmo.
Yeah, but apparently he was colluding with him,
mm.
even though he was the one who cancelled his visa. Anyway, all right, should we move off that?
Yes.
And I just wanted to quickly say that, you know, we've got news that Pell will have his case heard by the High Court. You've heard that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The ABC is basically talking about how this is, like, outrageous because, oh, what the hell, you know, he's already had his appeal and everything.
Yeah, he's had one appeal on him. Well, I just, like, you know, go to, what's his name, Leo Frank.
Well,
how many appeals he had.
Well, yeah, sure. Well, like, first of all, okay, like, this is not totally unprecedented. It is unusual in that that's usually where the appeals end. However, this is a very special case and not anything to do with him being privileged. In fact, it is the complete opposite. In Victoria, for cases like this anyway, you have to have a jury trial, and there is absolutely no doubt that the jury was extremely biased by all of the hit pieces on him, particularly on 60 Minutes and on the ABC, those stories, you know, which even, you know, kind of somewhat convinced me. I'm very skeptical of them now. It's a bullshit law in Victoria that you have to have jury trials. It should have been a judge trial, you know. And on the appeal, then what they had to do was, it was, you know, it was twofold. Not only did they have to find him not guilty, but they also had to find that the jury was in error, right, which is a, you know, means you've got two hurdles to go over, which is very, very difficult.
And like a jury in error is like, you know, that's one of the hardest things to do
right
in an appeal.
Yeah, because you have to say that, like, there was errors in law and stuff like that, which is very difficult to do. And by the way, if you think that, you know, the jury could have somehow not been biased, well, why then did the court implement a gag order after he was convicted the first time? He had another court date coming up, and that was for those charges relating to fondling the boys in the swimming pool, right? Mm. That was when the gag order was put in place. We all knew about it from international news. But that was put in place specifically to not bias the jury in the upcoming trial. Why would they have done that, you know? By the way, there was pretty much no point of that, you know. Back in the days when you had to get your news from the newspaper the next day, gag orders would have been useful. They're not anymore when everyone's connected to the internet. And again, that is a reason why there should not have been a jury trial. So, yes, this is unusual, but Pell's case is very unusual. So, therefore, he should be afforded the extra opportunity to have this heard in the High Court, whatever the bloody ABC has to say about it. Okay.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't know how this would... If I don't know really how to judge, like, my view of how the High Court would decide. I mean, it's like four girls and three guys. But, you know, on immigration, they tend to, like, you know, vote pretty decently.
Yeah. Look, I think the High Court...
And, like, because it's our High Court's less politicized.
Yeah, no, I was about to say, even when you've had, you know, what you could say are activist, judicial activists.
Well, the biggest one I would say Kirby.
Yes. But even Kirby was very good. I don't know if you've ever examined his record on the High Court.
No.
He was actually very fair, right? Yes, he has total fucking shit lib views. But when it actually came to applying the letter of the law, even a radical like Kirby was actually pretty good. So that's why I think it is quite important to take it to this level, where he can actually get an unbiased hearing based on the merits of the case and nothing else. Okay. So I don't want to languish too much on this topic, the ALP review.
Yeah, I have stuff on that.
Because we've basically gone through this ad nauseum before, and all the findings are exactly that, you know, exactly what we've been saying about it. But, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, kind of one thing that actually did surprise me was the swing away from Labor by young voters 25 to 34 against Labor by 4%.
Did it say where they're going, though?
No, it didn't really.
I mean, we would assume that, you know, that just kind of just a lot of them would go to the
Greens and go back, but...
Yeah, I mean, look, this tactic, you know, I do think that the appealing more to the kind of the Greens voters did actually work in Victoria.
Yeah.
You know, because Andrews, like, romped it in, and the Greens lost two upper house seats, I believe. Or was it... Something like that, I can't remember. They lost seats anyway. But it's very different because the Melbourne vote just depends on the fucking inner city shit urbanites, you know. it's a totally different story when you're talking nationally and you have big electorates like Kalgoorlie and Dixon and all that.
Yeah, the Herald article says there was younger voters in outer suburbs. And, you know, usually when you look at Australian maps and elections, you notice the red centres and then the blue, the big blue spread.
Yeah, yeah. So this review was done by the former South Australian Premier Jay Weatherall.
Yeah.
He's that guy with that really soothing ASMR voice. I don't know if you've seen. He's also the guy who had that epic spray at Josh Frydenberg for trashing South Australia's energy scheme. I was actually totally with Frydenberg on all that. That was when they had all the blackouts because they, you know, were using all unreliable energy. Is a term I think we should start using instead of renewable. And it was also conducted by Craig Wyala Wipeout Emerson. Now, they did... They did acknowledge, like, you know, everything we've been saying, but there was one thing they did not acknowledge, and that was immigration, actually. They mentioned, you know, the anti-worker green policies, which obviously were a huge
factor. And they were
factor.
Saying care needs to be taken to avoid Labor becoming a grievous-focused organisation.
Yeah, yeah, they even mentioned that, like getting into the...
this approach leads from moving of a to a culture moving one issue to the next, leading to a formulation of myriad policies that respond to a broad range of grievances, which is, you know, sounds like a permanent revolution kind of thing, you know? I mean, or a, you know, certain... certain ethnic tactics.
Yeah, yeah. That's why, you know, you can still be a Marxist without being a socialist.
Yes.
I believe there's honestly a lot of wisdom in that.
Well,
in that
Marx wanted a free market because it would piss people off.
Well, I wasn't quite going that way, but I just mean, like, in terms of, like, the dialectic permanent revolution and all of that, you can easily apply that to other systems. You know, neoconservatism, for example.
Yeah.
But anyway, one thing that seemed to be missing from the review was immigration, and I would say specifically work visas, you know. Like, Labor did talk about increasing the minimum wage for people on those visas, but they never really said anything about cutting them. And in the case of family visas, they talked about increasing them, actually. Now, unless you actually deal with that... because, you know, the ETU, the CFMMEU, they're all talking about it being part and parcel with these free trade agreements and having these floods of people come in who are not only undercutting wages but actually just putting people out of work. All these people, like people who want to, say, work on Adani, they're not just looking at that and saying, okay, we want you to open these places so we can go back to work. They're also saying that when you do open them, I want to still have the opportunity to work there, and I'm not going to be put out of work by some fucking Filipino on a 482. That was missing from the review, and they need to acknowledge that, because the rank-and-file traditional members who are members of unions, they know about that stuff, you know? Like, you know, it's a huge myth. I was hearing...
Even in the fucking shit Libya ones, they know it.
Yeah.
The guys at least know it.
You know, I think it's a huge myth, and I heard Eric Stryker saying this on the most recent episode of Strike and Mike, that, like, blue-collar people are uneducated and brainwashed, you know, just because they haven't been to university or something like that. But the fact that they haven't been to university and live in real working-class communities is precisely why they're not brainwashed. You know, they live in the real world. And they're smart enough to know that things like increasing immigration affects communities, affects wages, affects apprenticeships, affects the job market overall. Unlike the people who live in La La Land in inner city Melbourne, you know. They have some sense here and they should listen to them. Listen to their traditional constituency that actually were the birth of the party.
And well, it was... birthed under the tree of knowledge in Queensland, after all.
And also, Albo came out with a video the other day saying that the Labor Party needs to change and will change. You saw that, so he seemed to be finally acknowledging it. But
then there's nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
What have nothing we seen since then?
There's no programmatic specificity.
No, there's none whatsoever. All right.
It's not even detailed.
No.
And, so, like, you know, I heard things about, like, you know, certain, there were certain, like, little issues within, like, how Sean was running the campaign, you know, and, like, or, like, Sean being made the scapegoat for decisions endorsed by all Labor MPs. including environment spokesman Mark Butler and Tanya Pierce, who weren't mentioned in the report, in which Mr. Sean appears 77 times.
Right. Chris Bowen was mentioned, though. They couldn't yeah. forget about him.
No, they couldn't forget that little soundbite of if you don't like it.
Yeah, yeah. But also, I just mean, you know, policy-specific franking credits and negative gearing, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously,
well, the franking credits line, obviously, you support because it's just going to blow up the budget. And it's
it is, yes, I know. Watch out. That is a ticking time bomb, actually.
Mm. But any senior that can get on it, I advise them to do it.
But, you know, I do think, because one of the things the report also found, and Sky News kind of jumped all over this, is that, you know, the advertising from Palmer, the $40 million or whatever it is that he threw into it, that was a factor. I think they were absolutely right to point that out. But the nuance that I would add to that is that Labor made it easier for Palmer in the attack ads, you know. They gave the material, in other words. But, you know, certainly when political parties or opposition run ads, they do it for a reason. If they didn't work, they wouldn't spend all that money on it.
Yeah, we all remember that ad of Paul Ryan, like, pushing the old lady in the wheelchair to, like, the Grim Reaper or whatever it was.
I don't remember that, no.
Oh, that was back when I was a basic bitch, libertarian conservative.
I remember the one that Newt Gingrich did with Nancy Pelosi on climate change. I'm sure that was one of the cringy bloody ones I've ever seen.
There's that Ron. I know there's that Ron Paul ad where it points out every new thing that Newt Gingrich has like said and like done, and it's all like he's changing his. It's such a flip flop.
Yeah, no, he is one of the biggest backflippers on Capitol Hill, definitely. Yeah. Okay. I had a little bit of J news, actually. Mm. And that is, look, I couldn't find the verdict on this, but apparently Avi Yemini has been convicted of a string of charges relating to the last Victorian election, I think it was.
Mm.
So he was running, as was then the Australian Liberty Alliance, it's now Yellow Vest Australia. Now, of course, when you read the report here, he's the far-right political activist, Avi Yemini. But apparently what these charges were relating to was stalking another candidate, breaking electoral law by handing out how-to-vote cards. I don't know how that breaks the law. Candidates allowed to hand out how-to-vote cards, aren't they? Mm.
My memory, yes.
Yeah, I don't know.
Seen them do it.
Maybe there's a bit of detail there that they're not providing.
Mm.
But intimidated a fellow candidate, harassed people, and assaulted a candidate. Okay. Now, apparently the outcome of that case was supposed to be decided on the 6th of November, which was last week, and I was not able to find anything on that. But anyway, if we do, stay tuned. We'll see what it was. But the other interesting thing I read in this article, this is stuff I didn't know about. In 2014, he pled guilty to making a series of racist calls to a Melbourne rabbi. Have you heard about this one?
No.
Okay. And he was also convicted of assault against his ex-wife, and that involved screaming at her and then throwing a chopping board at her head. Now, he said that it was an accident, like he meant to just kind of throw it past her.
Yeah.
But I must point out that is still an assault.
Yeah.
So let's say it didn't actually hit her and it just flew past her. That is still technically legal.
Reminds me of, like, you know, she was about to hit them with the wine bottle. You know, he saw foot back in his massage training, IDF training. He thought it was like a bottle rocket.
Yeah. You know. It may well have been that. I don't know the ethnicity of his wife or ex-wife, as it is, but she said that it traumatized her and she doesn't know how she'll be able to have a functional relationship again in the future. Yeah. Interesting. I don't have the details on this prank, this call that he made. Apparently a racist call to a Melbourne rabbi, but he claimed it was a prank call. Because, you know, he does actually like to do these sort of chaser-style pranks, you know?
Yeah.
Where he goes out and does this kind of stuff. Problem is, he doesn't know how to do them very well, you know? It's like when you neg a girl. It's not good unless it works. Yeah.
It's like, otherwise, it's just fucking... Do you want to suck my dick? No. Yeah. Fuck you, bitch.
Have you ever seen those fail PUA videos?
Yeah.
Where they follow girls around? Oh, they're hilarious.
Well, I remember, like, Sam Hyde did this little, like, thing. He wanted to do, like, an autistic Kyle or whatever. And he just starts doing a PUA.
He's failed. I've seen that. Okay, so one other little piece of J news I had is, you know that Michael Danby is writing for The Australian now?
Yeah.
So this is something, I think this might only be recent though, but, you know, it's only 6 months since he got out of Parliament. And what's interesting here, if you don't know, Danby was a Labor MP, right? And I think back when David Hicks was back in Guantanamo Bay, apparently he was the only member of the Labor Party who opposed that, or at least opposed him being denied due process. He basically thought he should be left there to rot. But anyway, this recent article...
Of course he did.
...that he has for The Australian, like, can you guess what it's on? Do you think it's about Australian politics or anything of the kind?
Maybe it's about China being, like, you know, just a totalitarian communist state, maybe.
Well, I bet you'll be able to know what it's on when I give you the one piece of detail. It's about Jeremy Corbyn. Okay?
Of course.
So you know where this is going. He is an absolute rampant anti-Semite. And he also said that it would be a disaster if he were to be elected, and that Labour voters should vote for Boris Johnson instead. Okay? Now, this just absolutely screamed out kosher sandwich to me when I saw this story, right? Which is why I'm pointing it out, because this is a Labour man, and he is telling UK Labour voters to vote for the opposition party, okay? You know what I'm getting at here? It's like everything has to be seen through the prism of whether or not it's good for Jews. So in this case, you know, everything else be damned, whether it's the position on Brexit or the economy or social policy or whatever the bloody hell it is. No, because of the fact that Jeremy Corbyn has these very indirect affiliations with, you know, radical Palestinians and all these kind of things.
Did he point out him, like, defending that Anglican priest, what's his name, Stephen... Scarby? I can't remember his name.
No, he just went on about, you know, links to the PLO, and then, oh, he also threw in stuff about the IRA, you know, just to make it appear like it's just not about the anti-Semitism. Yeah. It's, you know,
Stephen Sizer.
Oh, no, I don't think that was in there. But, look, there's I've probably recommended this before, but I really recommend a debate on YouTube. I think there's only a snippet there, but it's between Alan Dershowitz and Dennis Prager. And they're talking about liberalism versus conservatism, but not which one is better overall for humanity or for America, but which one is better for Jews. So Dershowitz, of course, you know, will bring up, like, European anti-Semitism and Pat Buchanan, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then Dennis Prager will say, oh, no, but what about American Christians and Christian Zionism and the anti-Israel left? Again, it is completely viewed in that prism of which ideology benefits the Jews. And Danby is completely willing to throw all of his Labour Party colleagues under the bus because of this very indirect association with anti-Semitism by Jeremy Corbyn, you know? Read this article to get a better understanding of the kosher sandwich. That's what it was. Mm. Anyway. We're getting Jim Molan back, aren't we?
Yes.
Great. So I think that, you know,
thankfully Sino Dinas is, like, candidate was, like, one of the last ones that in the ballot.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we can really actually thank right wing extremist shock jock radio hosts, yes, like Alan Jones and what's his name? I always forget the name of the other guy. Gee, the other shock jock in Sydney.
Oh, Ray Hadley?
Ray Hadley, yes. You know, because they've been backing Molan over this. And that shows how this stuff really works, you know, because they will tell people, you know, like, phone your local senator, phone your local representative and tell them, we want this guy. And yeah, it works, you know. So, yeah,
Hey, yeah, call, communicating with representative, huh? What do you know?
Yeah, who would have, you know, that's what bloody Leibler does, you know?
But instead of phone calling, he organizes a meeting.
Hmm. And also, like, I think Aussies actually somewhat don't recognize how easy it is. Yeah, to get in touch. It's not like in America where, you know, congressmen are run off their feet all the time. To actually get the ear of your local representative, even in federal parliament, is actually relatively easy.
Yeah.
Maybe if not if they're a minister, but, you know.
Well, even like, you know, you can just go to the APH website, find your candidate, find their phone number and email address.
Yeah.
You'll probably get the staffer when you call them, but, you know, you can just let them, give them some, you know, reasonable statements. You know, exercise your democratic rights.
Yeah, and they will listen to you. Now, unfortunately, they do listen to the lobby groups and everything else too. But if enough people call in, they will listen to you. That's really actually all I had to say on Mullen. Mm.
Well, you know, I think it's just like a little... you don't know where the Liberal Party's going at this moment. Because you remember that candidate from Tasmania who had like... who got disendorsed because of the anti-Muslim Facebook posts.
Yeah, vaguely.
Yeah, and she's saying she'll try and seek re-endorsement, likely to.
Was she the Asian?
No.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say there have been a couple of Asians who've done that.
Well, I like the Liberal Party one that was like running like a massage like parlor.
Yeah, that's right. God. Jesus. No, but it's like... Asians have not been conditioned with political correctness to the same extent we have. You know, we're just brought up in a cradle to grave. They can speak a little bit more freely in China, and they even have bloody facial racial recognition software in China identifying Uyghurs, you know. And when black people steal their stuff, they put a sign out the front saying, no black allowed.
Yeah.
So just quickly, you know that the ABC have actually pulled that Q&A episode, like, entirely?
Oh, the violent...
The
violence.
Yes. And also, like, what's his name? The Outsiders guy. My brain is fried today, I think, maybe because of from the heat, but...
Oh, the old guy, Barry Cassidy?
No, not him. Outsiders, not Insiders. Hmm. You know, he used to be with Mark Latham and that. Sky News guy with the frizzy hair.
Oh.
Jesus.
I know who you mean. Ross Cameron.
No, not him. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He was saying, and rightly so, that the ABC should actually be referred to the police for inciting violence.
Yeah.
Because you know what? That's a crime. Now, I mean, in the case of Mona El-Tahawi, she was promoting vigilantism against men, right? Because she was saying she didn't want the police to do it, right? And then she even was basically saying that you should kill them in retaliation, you know? Now, I'm all for, like, a woman defending herself if she's groped or whatever. Yeah, you know, slap him or whatever. I'd prefer if you had a boyfriend there who would punch him instead. But, you know, you can't kill him. Right? And that seemed to be what she was implying by that. And then, you know, when you had that, amazingly biological female Aboriginal with a moustache was also said at the end, I want to see things burn. I can't wait till things burn or something like that.
Maybe she's just going to do some fire stick farming.
To do some out-of-control burning to flush out the animals. But yeah, that was the other thing. It was like... People seem to actually gloss over the fact that they may have committed a serious criminal offence by doing all of that. I think that episode is still up on YouTube, though, on the ABC's channel, but they disable the comments. Because I tried to comment nice moustache on that Aboriginal bloke and I wasn't able to. I actually think that the outcome of all of this has been positive because the ABC really overplayed their hand and this time normies noticed it, you know, because it was subject to a number of complaints from viewers. And I think a few of them were actually on the left as well, you know.
Yeah, it was like bad optics.
And if anyone had any doubt as to ABC bias before, well, you know, it should be plainly obvious now. And now the ABC is kind of going, oh, shit, we better rein it in a bit, you know. So yeah, no, I'm glad actually that this happened. Okay, you know what? I had something on the NDIA, but it looks pretty boring, so that's actually pretty much all I have. Unless you have anything else.
Nah, I mean,
it's actually somewhat of a slow news week this week, and I haven't eaten since Sunday, so I'm really looking forward to my dinner tonight. So, yeah, thank you for joining us on episode 51 of The Racist War. Please stay safe and do consider making a donation to the Salvos if you can for people affected by the bushfires. And we'll see you next week.
Catch you, cunts.